Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Donald Trump is zigzagging wildly on the Jeffrey Epstein case. He's acting like a man motivated by extreme fear. And he looks it, too. He seems to have aged 10 years in the last few months. One day, he screams at his own supporters, demanding that they, quote-unquote, stop talking about Epstein. When has that kind of demand ever worked? Then he claims that the very Epstein files, which he said on the campaign trail he was going to release, do not exist. In fact, he gets really confusing and says simultaneously that they don't exist and that they were written by Dems. Then he switches gears and says that he'll ask Pam Bondi to release all credible parts of the files that don't exist. A day later, he's screaming again that it's all a hoax and telling everyone to shut the hell up about it. And a day after that, he's saying that his DOJ will lean on the judges involved to unredact all of the evidence against Epstein that they used during grand jury proceedings. Trump acts like a man who is very afraid of something. So afraid it's made him half unhinged and desperate to put an end to any inquiries into the subject, flailing about from one extreme to another just to make it all go away. Sadly for Trump, it's not going away. The really intense phase of this madness began around the time that Netanyahu visited Trump a week or two ago. I think the real reason for all the flailing is not that there are any new glimpses of Trump's friendship with Epstein in the files. Everybody knows they were pals for years, and Trump is still a close associate of Epstein's attorney, Alan Dershowitz. I won't say his friend. Such beings as Dersh don't have friends in the sense we can. The knife is always sharp and always handy should a need or advantageous opportunity arise. If you want to feel viscerally how powerful Jews think about others they work with, watch the behavior of the Jewish gangsters portrayed in the 2011 film Drive. If the current holders of the real Epstein files had something on Trump, they'd probably only release it if Trump breaks with them. And I just don't see principle-free, egoist Trump doing anything like that, though I hope I'm wrong. So that's unlikely to be what's making him afraid. It may be, though, that Trump is being asked to do even more than usual for the Jewish power structure, something that outrages even his flexible moral standards. Or perhaps he has been, quote-unquote, asked to stop the release of some of these files, the files he promised to release, because they would seriously hurt the Jewish state. And he is now committing political suicide because otherwise some loved one of his will be hurt or killed. I don't know the answer, but I do know, and as Tucker Carlson just said, everybody in Washington knows, that Israel was neck deep in Epstein's disgusting operation. And I think that Trump is very, very afraid right now. And now let's hear the second piece I published on Epstein more than 10 years ago, January 2015's Jeffrey Epstein, More Light. While you learn about this case today and in the coming days and months, remember who it is who has told you the truth about this horrific abuse of our girls and women and of our nation and people. Who has told you the truth from the very beginning? The National Alliance. Now listen.
There are a lot of names in Jeffrey Epstein's Little Black Book. Epstein is the billionaire Jewish oligarch who used hundreds of white teen girls, some as young as 12, as sex slaves, and traded their sexual services to the rich and powerful in exchange for who knows what favors, and then claimed the ultimate favor when he was caught. The favor of a sweetheart non-prosecution deal. I covered the basics of his sex slave operation on last week's program. Epstein's contact book was made public by the oligarch's former houseman, Alfredo Rodriguez. Rodriguez was arrested and served time after he failed to turn the book over to prosecutors and instead tried to sell it to attorneys involved in the case. Rodriguez said that the book would be invaluable in discovering the full extent of Epstein's sex operations, which covered at least 3 states and 2 continents. Rodriguez stated that he had circled the names of individuals who either participated in or witnessed the sexual abuse that took place at Epstein's multiple mansions, private jets, and private island. Those who would in some way be valuable material witnesses in the case. The Little Black Book reads like a who's who of elite Jews and their Gentile figureheads, along with a list of dozens upon dozens of girls, listed by their first names and telephone numbers only, who were available to provide quote-unquote massage services for Epstein and his wealthy friends in the Virgin Islands, in Paris, in New Mexico, in Florida, in New York City, and other locations. A couple of months ago, just before the Epstein case exploded in the headlines again, Rodriguez died. He was 60 years old. Not including the much-discussed Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew, here are just a few of the well-known names in Epstein's contact book. Dr. Elie Wiesel, professional Jewish Holocaust survivor. The late Senator Ted Kennedy, author of so much anti-white immigration and other legislation. The Jewish advisor to and handler of presidents since the 1960s, Henry Kissinger. The Jewish senior Clinton advisor, Ira Magaziner. Fox News founder and hyper-Zionist Rupert Murdoch. Wall Street vulture and Jewish billionaire Ronald Perelman. Jewish comedian Joan Rivers. Ultra-wealthy Jewish bankers Edouard de Rothschild and Evelyn de Rothschild. The late Jewish banker Edmund Safra. Saudi Prince Salman. The late Jewish actor, director, producer, and neocon, Ron Silver. The son of uber-oligarch George Soros, the wealthy Jew Peter Soros, whose name was circled, and Epstein had no fewer than 10 contact numbers for him. The black governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, Charles Turnbull. 2 different governors of New Mexico, where Epstein owned a huge estate, Bruce King and Bill Richardson. Convicted Jewish insider trader Sam Waxel. The late Jewish TV journalist Mike Wallace. Jewish TV personality Barbara Walters. Jewish Hollywood mogul Bob Weinstein. Jewish media sex expert Dr. Ruth Westheimer. Israeli leader Ehud Barak, whose name was circled and for whom 8 contact numbers were listed. Hyper-aggressive Zionist lawyer Alan Dershowitz, whose name was also circled and for whom 15 contact numbers were given. Jewish media mogul and former head of Disney, Michael Ovitz. David Rockefeller. Donald Trump, whose name was circled and for whom 17 methods of contact were listed. Jewish businessman Les Wexner, whose name was circled and for whom an impressive 71 ways of contact were given. Jewish publisher Mortimer Zuckerman, whom Epstein could contact in any one of 21 different ways, and many, many more. You can read them at nationalvanguard.org. Epstein's Little Black Book also has 26 entries listed under the title Jeffrey's Apartments for Models, including one for, quote, Jean-Luc Brunel and guest, close quote, 301 East 66th Street, New York City. Brunel, who ran a modeling agency, has been named as a sexual predator himself and procurer of underage girls for Epstein. Court documents show that the 301 East 66th address is for condos owned by Epstein, where girls trafficked into the U.S. by Brunel for Epstein would be housed. Epstein reportedly even had the audacity to charge the young girls rent while they were being abused. Vanity Fair columnist Michael Wolff met Epstein in the late 1990s when he was invited to fly on Epstein's private Boeing 727. He says, quote, "It was all a little giddy. There's a little food out. After 15 to 20 minutes, Jeffrey arrives. This guy comes on board. He was my age, late 40s, and he had a kind of Ralph Lauren look to him, a good-looking Jewish guy in casual attire. And he was followed onto the plane by, how shall I say this, by three teenage girls, not his daughters," close quote. Wolff saw Epstein's offices, too, where his mysterious financial dealings made him worth some $2 billion. Wolff said, quote, "It's an incredibly strange place. It has no corporate affect at all. The trading floor is filled with guys in yarmulkes. Who they are, I have no idea. They're like a throwback, a bunch of guys from the 50s. So here is Jeffrey in this incredibly beautiful office with pieces of art and a view of the courtyard, and he seems like the most relaxed guy in the world. You want to say, what's going on here? And he gives you that Cheshire smile." Close quote. Epstein's Florida estate was on posh Palm Beach Island. But the teen girls he abused were mostly from across the water in West Palm Beach, where working and middle-class whites worked hard, sent their children to public schools, and lived in very modest homes, sometimes even trailers. In those schools, Epstein's procurers were at work. One older teenager, Haley Robson, had massaged Epstein just once, but agreed to lure younger girls to him for $200 for each successful recruitment. Robson was one of many young female procurers who sought out white female teens at restaurants, malls, and schools. According to New York Magazine, quote, "Skinny, beautiful young girls were approached by other girls who said they could make $200 by massaging a wealthy man naked. Robson said Epstein had told her, the younger the better. The rules were simple. Tell him you're 18. There might be some touching. You could draw the line. The more you do, the more you are paid." A couple of the girls said they went all the way into the experience. One told police she visited 50 times, another hundreds of times, both having sex with Epstein and Nada Marcinikova, then a 19-year-old beauty, who Epstein told one of them was his sex slave. He'd purchased her from her family back in Yugoslavia. Close quote. And there were hundreds of these girls. The Palm Beach police uncovered 40. Epstein demanded their services, sometimes several at a time, often several times a day. Some girls reported being used by Epstein literally hundreds of times each. Two of the girls, who'd just made $500 in one weekend with Epstein, reportedly crowed in their abuser's limo on the way home that, quote, "We'll soon be rich," close quote. But such giddy optimism didn't always last, nor did it always occur. Many victims reported remorse, tears, depression, and shame after being manipulated by Epstein and his team, performing innumerable sex acts for Epstein and his friends, and deceiving their own families. Let's talk for a moment about these teenage daughters of white working families. Obviously, these teens were no match for Epstein, Maxwell, and his sophisticated team of procurers, who had mastered the art of manipulating these star-struck, troubled, or destitute schoolgirls. That's why there are laws against child sex and child trafficking and sexual slavery. But with Epstein and company, we have to consider the disparity in economic power, too. Jeffrey Epstein is reportedly worth some $2 billion. These schoolgirls probably own nothing, and many of their families next to nothing. It's been said that many working people these days are literally driving their net worth to work every day. With the mounting debt that characterizes our banker-ridden society, many working families probably have a negative net worth. But for the sake of illustration, let's assign these abused girls a net worth of $20,000, or a ratio of 0.00001 compared to Jeffrey Epstein's wealth. That means that when generous Jeff paid them $200 to abuse their innocence and massage him, it was to Epstein the equivalent of 0.2 cents per sex session when compared to the girl's economic position. Epstein's thrice daily sessions cost him the equivalent of 0.6 cents per day, 4.3 cents per week, less than $2.25 per year for over 1,000 sex sessions with innumerable teenage white girls. And here's another way to look at Epstein's wealth. If you found yourself accused of a serious crime, you'd quickly find that good legal representation, including an aggressive investigative team, could easily cost you $250,000. To Jeffrey Epstein, that's the equivalent of $2.50. A dream team of lawyers, like the one that got him off incredibly lightly for his crimes, might cost 10 times that amount. But if we compare his wealth to that of his accusers, the cost of the Dershowitz-Kinstar dream team was just like $25. During the initial case back in 2005, Epstein's friend and, according to witnesses, co-abuser of young white girls, Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz, spearheaded a team of private eyes who looked into the backgrounds of prosecutors, police, and the girls themselves. He provided police and the state attorney's office with comments from a few of the victims on the social media site MySpace, where they admitted to drug and alcohol use and made a few sexual remarks. He found out one troubled teen victim had been in trouble for stealing from a Victoria's Secret store. Epstein's legal team reportedly harassed the family of one 14-year-old victim before her grand jury testimony. Palm Beach police stated that victims were contacted and told, quote, "Those who help Epstein will be compensated, and those who hurt him will be dealt with," close quote. And after the dream team negotiated with local and federal authorities for Epstein, the strangest part of the non-prosecution agreement that resulted was that Epstein actually welcomed civil suits by the victims against him, doubtless hoping to pacify them with money so that no further criminal charges would ensue. And some 17 victims were paid off, 7 of them reportedly walking away with $1 million each, to Jeffrey Epstein, the equivalent of $10. The Palm Beach police were apparently honest and uncorrupted, as pointed out by researcher Robert Morrow. Their investigations produced volumes of evidence proving that Jeffrey Epstein and his procurers were guilty of hundreds of sex crimes and other felonies. But the fix was in. Barry Krischer, the very Jewish state's attorney for Palm Beach, refused to prosecute Epstein on any of the major charges, despite the evidence. The end result was that Epstein was only charged with a single count of soliciting prostitution, the same charge a man would get if he yelled, "How much?" as he passed a cop posing as a street hooker. Only extreme public pressure forced the single charge to be upgraded to soliciting a minor for prostitution. The outraged police chief, Michael Reiter, asked to be removed from the case in protest. He wrote to the victims, telling them that justice was not being done. He accused Barry Krischer of being influenced by money. I would say it was also a case of tribal loyalty. He turned the case over to the Federal Justice Department and the FBI, who promptly negotiated the infamous non-prosecution agreement with Epstein's legal team and filed no charges whatever in the case, and even immunized Epstein's associates from any future prosecution and sealed this highly irregular proceeding, making it secret. This wasn't the only time that Barry Krischer had let a Jewish sex criminal's prosecution slide. According to witnesses, in November 2006, a Jew named Jason Schenfeld lured two young women to his bedroom, attacked them with a knife, bound them with duct tape, and forced them to perform sex acts by threatening to sic his pit bull on them if they did not. Rape porn videos in which an attacker was portrayed raping women after binding them with duct tape were also found in Schenfeld's possession. The women bore serious wounds from their ordeal. When the women told their story, state's attorney Barry Krischer refused to prosecute Schenfeld, citing alleged inconsistencies in their accounts and some unflattering things in the young women's backgrounds. Just 5 months after being released by Krischer, Jason Schenfeld attacked, raped, and murdered another young white woman, 18-year-old Amanda Buckley, who was found stuffed in Schenfeld's closet, her body wrapped in bloody sheets, her hair stuck to duct tape, and her body severely bruised. After being raped, she died of strangulation. Along with the FBI and Washington's Department of Justice, Barry Krischer was instrumental in letting Jeffrey Epstein get away with his crimes. One of Epstein's friends told New York Magazine writer Philip Weiss that Epstein thinks there's an anti-Semitic conspiracy against him. Epstein's fellow Jew, close friend, and according to at least one witness, co-participant in sexual abuse, Alan Dershowitz, also sees it that way. And so do Dershowitz's supporters. One commenter at the Jewish Daily Forward, Rabbi Bernard Rosenberg, puts it bluntly, quote, "Alan Dershowitz is a scholar who has fought for Jews and Israel and for preserving the memory of the Holocaust. There is no truth in the accusations against him. I have never claimed to be God's voice, but I know the anti-Semites and anti-Zionists are enjoying this accusation, which will be proven in a court of law to be false. We Jews should speak up for one who defends Israel and the Jewish people." Close quote. Dershowitz has claimed on television that he will seek the disbarment of the attorneys working for the victims in this case, and that he never saw anything improper, never met or saw any underage women at Jeffrey Epstein's estates or on his airplanes, and that he only visited Epstein while in the constant company of his wife. But just yesterday, the passenger manifests of Epstein's aircraft were released, and they showed Dershowitz as a passenger on several occasions without being accompanied by his wife, and on the same flights in which several female passengers were, quite curiously, listed only by their first names: Hazel, Claire, Tatiana, and others. This is an affair, I think, in which the tragedy is behind us. The tragedy of the manipulation and abuse of young white women, which is all too common in our sick, declining society. But I predict it is going to end well. The victim's current lawsuit may well succeed, exposing our ruling class Jews for what they really are, forcing a new prosecution, and exposing the deep corruption by Jewish money and tribal loyalty of our legal system, and especially of the Washington regime's wildly misnamed Justice Department. And if the lawsuit does not succeed, and the criminals once again walk free, the thoughtful and aware portion of our people, those who have followed this case with mounting horror and outrage, will never again look at Washington, or at the legal system, or at the Jews in quite the same way again. And that is a very positive development.